Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to welcome back Bruce Allison, certified arborist. He's an adjunct professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology in the College of Ag and Life Sciences at UW-Madison, and he is with us to talk about trees and fall tree care. Questions or comments for him? I hope you'll join in at 1-800-642-1234. You can also email us at talk@wpr.org or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a comment there, or if you have a photograph of a tree you want identified or maybe a disease shows up in your photo, drop it in. We'll be glad to take a look at it. And Bruce Allison, welcome back.
Well, Larry, wonderful to be back with you.
It's great to have you here. We had a question from a listener before we go to the phones, and we'll get to Mike in Castle Rock in just a minute. But someone was wondering, what is the best way to select a professional arborist, and how do we know if we need one?
Well, it's tough. Selecting any contractor can be a challenge, be it a plumber, electrician, a builder, whatever. And your decision is going to have impact later on. And so you definitely want to choose an arborist who is, number one, very familiar with all the changes that have occurred in arboriculture over the past 10, 15, 20 years and occurring as we speak. I mean, every time a new journal comes out, there's a new thought on some proper technique for pruning or managing hazard trees or whatever it might be. The best source is to, number one, make sure that they are active in the International Society of Arboriculture and are a certified arborist. And there's different levels of certification. There's a certified tree worker, there's a certified arborist general, and then there's a board certified master arborist. Any certified arborist is going to have to go through the process, number one, of taking an exam to prove some level of competence and familiarity with all of the rules and changes that occur, and also are required to have continuing education so that they are going to be reading literature that comes out and are going to conferences also and participating in all of that. So there is a chapter of the International Society of Arboriculture in Wisconsin called the Wisconsin Arborist Association, grown exponentially in those years that I've been there. And membership in that, I think, would be critical and an active membership.
Sure.
It's not just enough to belong, but also that International Society of Arboriculture generally attending those national conferences and reading their literature. So look for a certified arborist. And then, of course, just do your due diligence in talking to neighbors. Ask that arborist, you know, who have you worked for in this neighborhood? And then you talk to, you know, Joe Blow down the street, and they said, yeah, he's a certified arborist, but boy, he, you know, just overcharges or is not really cleaning up the way, you know, I would like them to clean up. So that's the two best sources is, number one, make sure that their professional associations have, you know, taken a look at them and given them that knowledge base. And number two, make sure your neighbors feel comfortable with what they are doing actually in the field.
We have Mike in Castle Rock with a question for you. So let's go right to Mike. Hi, thank you for calling.
Good morning. I've got a dwarf pine tree that's cone-shaped, and I don't know what variety is, and I'd like to move it. It's not quite dwarf anymore, and it's being overtaken by some arborvitae. So what's the best time to move something like that?
Well, conifers, the best time to move them is before October. A University Extension bulletin suggests that if you wait too late for conifers, because conifers continue to have their needles and will have evapotranspiration or loss of moisture. So they're much more vulnerable to being moved later. Because every time you move, even though you think you're taking a pretty good size root ball, you're nonetheless leaving some of those roots behind. And so there's less surface area for water to be taken up. I would say the best time would be early in the spring. Select your site very carefully and then make sure that you get in there as soon as the ground has no longer frozen and move it at that time. And then not only timing, but how you plant the tree is critical. Make sure that that hole is not too deep. It's no deeper than the size of that root ball that you're taking with it. And make it more saucer-shaped than bowl-shaped. Those roots remain mostly in that top horizon of soil. So making sure that your soil has been opened up so those roots can pretty quickly move out in a lateral motion is also very important. water it heavily, protect it from any wildlife you might have there, be they meadow vole or deer, whatever it might be that could possibly set it back in that spring months.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Lisa in Madison, on to you now. Hi, Lisa.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question for Bruce. We have a mature tulip tree in our front yard, and it's probably been at the site for, I don't know, 50 or 60 years. And last summer, it was diagnosed with anthracnose. We saw a lot of premature leaf drop. It seemed to recover from that, but in the spring, when the leaves started to emerge, they only probably opened up to probably about a third of the size that they usually are, and we saw very minimal flowering. So my concern is that, you know, are we at risk of losing this tree, which I would hate because it is such a unique tree in the area, and if there's anything that you would recommend that we could do to sort of help to encourage it and hopes that it does a full recovery by next year.
Okay, so Lisa, is this a tulip poplar tree, Liriodendron tulipifera, or is it a magnolia tree?
No, it's the tulip, the first one.
Liriodendron, okay, so it's going to be, it's going to grow 100 feet tall, and it's going to be a good size tree. And it's interesting that you would bring that up because it's been observed just recently in Wisconsin that as the winter temperatures are changing, the range of the tulip poplar tree is now moving into southern Wisconsin, which is interesting because it's a very interesting tree. I mean, it grows quite rapidly. It grows very tall. It's very shade intolerant and has some uses as a forest product tree, but also, as you observe, is a beautiful tree. It's not really a poplar tree at all. It's related to the magnolias, and that's why it has that beautiful tulip-like flower.
Flower, yep.
That stands out. So anthracnose, you know, I'm a little surprised, but there's a variety of anthracnose fungi that can affect leaves, and I've not seen a lot of anthracnose on tulip poplar, but that doesn't mean that, you know, as things are changing and, you know, the fungi that are not prevalent all of a sudden follow their hosts up here. Too big of a tree to be worrying about trying to spray. As you know, anthracnose or any foliar fungus is really just sort of established because of certain environmental conditions. So you might have had, you know, moisture on those leaves during that period of sporulation. You'll get the anthracnose. It's never going to kill the tree per se, but it certainly, you know, can make it unsightly for a short time. I would say keeping the tree vigorous. Trees are self-optimizing organisms. They have, over their evolutionary life, develop defenses against all of those pests that are problematic. If you keep it vigorous with adequate water during periods of drought, and adequate in our climate zone means about 4 inches per month. That's what our normal rainfall is, about 40 inches a year. So during the growing period, about 4 inches a month or about an inch a week. Make sure you've taken care of it there. Make sure that when you prune it, you don't over-prune it. That is, you don't want to reduce the crown, you know, any more than 10% at one particular time, because that will change that internal homeostasis or that balance that exists in the tree, that is all chemically controlled. And if you cut too much, you have all these sprouts coming back. The tree reacts to that in a way that depletes its reserve carbohydrates. You don't want to do that.
Okay. So it is also very susceptible to aphids, which in the past few years have been, you know, to the point where, you know, we have the honeydew dripping on our cars.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything to help alleviate that?
Yeah, well, the aphids, of course, are noticeable because of that honeydew. What they're doing is sucking all of that extra carbohydrates out of the tree, and it's sloughing off and dripping down, and that can be a bit of a nuisance underneath. Usually an aphid attack is not going to be so severe that it throws the tree health off in any significant way. If you choose to, you certainly, on those branches that you can reach, spray those aphids when you see them with an insecticidal soap. Just go to a normal garden center or, you know, one of the general purpose stores like Home Depot or Menards or whatever, and get insecticidal soap. You don't have a big machine to be able to toss it up, but sometimes you can get one of these jars on the end of your hose, and there's about 40, you know, PSI. That's usually enough to shoot it up high enough where you can get a significant amount of the aphids washed off. So it's a very low, impact way of dealing with aphids.
Mm-hmm. There you go.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And Robert and Nina, we are on to you now. Hi, Robert.
Hi, Larry, Bruce. Quick question. About 14 years ago, my son planted a scarlet oak in my yard, and it has grown to the point now where the lower branches are hanging over my neighbor's property, and it makes him difficult to mow his lawn. I'm wondering if this is a good time of the year. I know you can't do it during the summer. Is this a good time of year for me to be able to trim off some of those lower branches?
Yeah, Robert, it's an excellent time of year. And the issue, of course, is oak wilt, which
right.
is a systemic fungus that's introduced through wounds. And root grafts, but in your case, it would be a matter of wounds. And I'm sure that scarlet oak must be just absolutely beautiful this time of year with just
wonderful.
A vibrant color, so you want to protect that. No, this would be a perfect time in terms of oak wilt. The recommendations from the Department of Natural Resources is somewhat changed now. Foresters can go back into the northern woods as early as mid-July. And feel comfortable that their activity, if they don't intentionally start making wounds, are going to spread the problem. But for homeowners, it's still probably a good idea to wait, well into September. October is a great time. And then do not return to pruning after April 1, because suddenly, even though we used to say April 15th, now we realize that with a shorter winter, that is degree days increasing, that the tree starts growing, becomes more vulnerable to oak wilt then.
Mm-hmm.
The other key thing is to prune properly. Pruning lower branches usually is not particularly problematic because of something called the autonomous limb theory that says each limb has to produce its own carbohydrates. It can't draw the food from those limbs higher up in full sunlight. And so lower branches are already somewhat stressed anyway. And so taking off those lower branches will not have any adverse effect upon the general health of the tree as long as it's done, to a moderate level. And pruning properly, that is cutting back to the branch bark collar, finding that area of swelling, that collar, if you will, at the intersection of the branch, the more upright branch and the horizontal, upright trunk rather, and the horizontal branch coming out, leaving that, because that's the group of cells that will divide rapidly and close up or callus over that pruning wound. So don't leave a stub, but don't cut it too flush either.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, one other question. It's about 15 feet tall. Can I take off about a third?
I would not exceed any more than a third of lower branches.
Okay.
And if you can just get away with pruning those that are problematic on your neighbor's side and leaving for growth those on the other side, that would be, probably the best of all solutions.
Yeah, there you go. Thanks, Robert. Good luck. Appreciate your call. Bruce Allison, certified arborist, adjunct professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking trees on this edition of Garden Talk with Bruce Allison. Great to have you listening in. Thank you so much for tuning us in today. Join in with your own questions at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mealer Show, and you can post right there. An email from Nick, who wonders about ginkgos, Bruce. When buying a ginkgo to plant, how do you know you're getting a male, and any tips on raising ginkgos?
Well, it's a tough one. You'd hope that the grower would have certified these as the male. And the reason for that is that the ginkgo is dioecious. They have a male and a female producing pollen versus the nut. It's not really a fruit because it's not an angiosperm. It's actually a gymnosperm. So it's actually the naked seed that it's producing over there and covered with a little flesh that has a very strong smell. as it ages on the lawn and whatever. So that's why some people, especially in the United States, choose not to plant the female ginkgo tree. I personally think it's interesting to have some of those, but not right near the house because it has a very, very strong smell of rancid butter and dog droppings, and people just simply don't want to have that dragged into the house. So you're only going to have to depend upon the certification of the grower that they have cloned just those varieties, which they are sure are female and not, the male and not the the seed-producing one. And you'll find out, usually it takes about 20 years, and I've had more than one client say, oh, my gosh, you know, I was guaranteed this was going to be a male, and it's indeed the female. And how do you take care of them? Well, number one, select one that has a nice, strong central stem. Try to avoid that codominance. And sometimes those ginkgos can develop a double leader, and that's a problem because that area tends to more quickly fall apart under windstorms or ice storms and whatever. You'd like to avoid that. Once you get a plant established, you'd like to have it be there for the next 100 years or so. Adequate moisture, again, is important as much as possible. Put some shredded bark mulch around the base to stop any competition from lawn and weeds that might take the moisture away. And those are the best things you can do. And in terms of pruning, again, they're not really a high-maintenance tree at all. In fact, they're a wonderfully low-maintenance tree, both from the perspective of pruning, but also from the perspective of pests. There just really aren't many pests that are a problem there.
Very cool. We have Tim in Green Bay with a question for you, Bruce. So let's go to Tim. Hi, Tim.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I've got some yews in my yard, and it seems like every time I prune my yews, I get a lot of die-off in some of the branches, and it takes about a year for them to come back, and just want to know what the best time of the year to do it is, because to avoid that die-off on branches.
All right, Tim, what time had you normally been doing this that you had those die back?
Probably in the spring of the year.
Sometime in the spring. Okay, well, I'm a little surprised about the die-back. Sometimes the die-back might, do you use a shears, or do you just do it with a hand pruner?
I've been using a shears. I've got several types. I mean, I've got the electric one, and then I've got a hand pruner and a lopper as well.
Okay.
I mean, not lopper, but the longer scissors type pruner.
All right. Sometimes when you use those electric shears, they will cut off some, but they will only partially damage some of the others. So they will have, you know, partially girdle some of the other stems. And when you take a look at the browning that might remain afterwards on stems that are still attached, but are now browned out, you might see that they actually had been damaged somewhere down on the lower bark, and that might have been the source. Typically, if you're doing it in the spring, I wouldn't expect to see winter damage because, again, as we had spoken about before, evergreens are constantly losing moisture. Their means of distributing water and nutrients is evapotranspiration. They're dependent upon those needles to pull water up, and that through capillary action and cohesion pulls everything up from the ground. And if you are a deciduous tree, you're able to drop that so you can preserve moisture. But if you are an evergreen, you're holding out of that, so you're continuing to lose moisture. So quite often, if you've had especially a dry year near the foundation where it tends to be a little bit droughtier anyway, you will tend to get what's known as winter burn. It doesn't show up until the spring, but it actually occurred during the winter when you had desiccation as a result of moisture leaving and not enough moisture to replace it from the ground. So what I would suggest doing is doing your pruning as you're doing in the spring after your first flush of growth. That is, let that first growth come out, then cut it back. Do not be too severe in cutting back, because if you're too severe, you're going to, again, throw that normal homeostasis off that exists in the plant and cause it to either grow too quickly, or you might even have dieback occurring on some of those big stems. And then I would strongly encourage you on those yews in this, right, like right now, soak up the soil around those trees so that you reduce the chance of winter damage occurring. There are not many foliar diseases of the yew, so I don't know that you're really dealing with a disease issue. I suspect it's more of an abiotic or environmentally related, you know, temperature or extra heat up against it. But now's a good time to do it, and I highly recommend that before you prune, you get our UW-Madison Horticulture Extension professor, Laura Jolz, did a beautiful job for UW Extension called How to Properly Prune Evergreens. Just go on the internet to Google that in or go to Learning Store, and I'm sure the Larry Miller show is going to have that listed also. That'll give you some great ideas on how to prune evergreens generally.
And thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. Ralph and Slinger, we are moving to you now. Hi, Ralph.
Good morning, Larry.
Morning.
And Dr. Allison. I was wondering if there was anything new in the treatment of white pine blister rust and another disease which has taken almost all of our butternuts. I don't know the name of the disease here on Cedar Lake.
Oh. Well, and yes, I mean, with white pine blister rust, which was a huge problem in the state of Wisconsin in the past, it was a canker disease that would cause ulcerations in the woody tissue, and it had a fungus that had its alternate host being the buckthorn. And that's why early on in the state of Wisconsin legislature, they actually banned people from having the buckthorn, because the buckthorn, I'm jumping stories here. The buckthorn was for a wheat rust. It was the alternate host was the ribes, which was also banned also because it would bounce back and forth between that. And eradicating the ribes early on was very helpful in reducing the white pine blister rust. But then they also were able to cultivate some more white pine blister rust diseased varieties of white pine. So usually I see from those white pine that are selected from the state forest nursery or from garden centers that those are selected to great resistance. People that sort of move just native trees up from a northern cabin down lower, I tend to see more white pine blister rust as a problem on those. So be careful, you know, selecting the right one is important. The old story used to be that if you prune the lower branches, you also had greater ventilation and less chance for that infection to occur because it occurred first on the needles and then went into the woody tissue. Now, on that butternut decline, it was a terrible loss. In 1967 is when it really became obvious that we were losing the butternut, which was a very important tree, not so much ornamentally, but you know, covered large parts of southern Wisconsin and off to the west particularly. And it's sometimes called the white walnut. The black walnut is its close cousin. And this, again, was a canker disease, and it just took out almost all the butternuts. You hardly see them in the woods anymore, and you certainly don't see them available as landscape trees. And yes, the good news is that there are people that are working on improvements and selection of the butternut and also even black walnut improvement going on. And there is, if you Google forest genetics, black walnut, and butternut conservation programs, David Stevens, who's part of the UW Tree Improvement Research Specialist, has done some great work on butternut improvement programs, and there might be something available, hopefully in the not-too-distant future, where we can start enjoying that butternut once again.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling, Ralph. Lots of callers online here. We also have some emails. Beth from Madison says, I inherited a sour cherry tree when we moved into our home 4 years ago. It's an old tree. It's starting to decay. Woodpeckers are happily making holes in many of the branches. However, the cherry yield is huge and very delicious, so I'm hesitant to cut the tree down. I would prefer to graft a branch onto a new rootstock and plant a new tree in the same site in the near future. Is there a way to go about doing this?
Yes, there is. And I, again, would, for that particular plant, the cherry, I would, again, use this wonderful resource of the internet where you can cut, and usually want to cut early in the spring when the tissue is softer and be able to take that cutting and then to introduce that into the right medium so that roots can be set and then grow from that. One of the books that may not be around anymore, but was published by Simon & Schuster. It's called the Encyclopedia of Practical Gardening, and they had a whole section on plant propagation and how to, you know, properly take leaf cuttings, budding, and grafting. I always found that very useful. I'm sure there's some other books out there to
Michael Durr has one, doesn't he?
Michael Durr might have one on propagation. He certainly has done a beautiful job in chronicling all of the different species, the landscape trees, and some beautiful photographs, and he probably includes some of that. You know, Michael Durr, who used to be at the University of Illinois, I think he's moved on to some other spot. But D-I-R-R, you might want to check into that one also. And it's, unfortunately, a lot of these fruit trees, you know, weren't selected for longevity. They were, you know, selected for, you know, beautiful, delicious fruit being produced. And so you always want to have, you know, another one planted in reserve. And if it's possible, you might want to find out which cultivated variety that you actually have, and you might be able to access that through, you know, a garden center that specializes in fruit trees. I know Hilltop is one, Stark Brothers is another one, Young's Garden Center also likes doing that type of thing, and you might find someone at some of the other nurseries, but particularly, you know, those that those nurseries and growers that specialize in fruit-producing trees would be a good site to go to. But yes, you definitely, there's no reason in the spring you couldn't find a way to clone. In fact, it might be a wonderful, fun thing for you to do. Seed is not going to do it because it won't necessarily go back to that same genotype that you have on that particular tree, which sounds like it's really producing nicely. I worry a little bit when you say it has a huge cherry yield. If it's particularly high this year, so there's something called a distress crop that happens on trees when they are near death. All of the carbohydrates start to go into other parts of it where they are able to produce extra seed because they, you know, don't have a sense, because trees don't have brains necessarily, although there's a great intelligence that has evolved into those plants, that they might not be there, but their seed and individuals, their progeny, will around them. So cloning would be a wonderful idea.
Deborah in Soldiers Grove, on to you now. Hi, Deborah.
Hi. About a month ago, we had some really high winds, and it totally took out this pretty major branch on my red maple. And it took out, like, quite a bit of the trunk where it is, and it's probably about 10 feet at the top to down to the 6 feet right above another branch. And I'm trying to figure out if I should top it off. That's what my husband wants to do. He wants to top it off and, like, kind of cut it down so it'll make, like, a ball or whatever. Or I don't know if I can just, like, patch it up with some tar or what I can do.
Okay, Deborah, well, let me ask you a couple questions first. When you say red maple, is that like a Norway red maple, like a Schweidler or Crimson King, or is that a native red maple, the Acer rubra, which has a beautiful red color only in the fall but is normally green during the year?
It's normally green during the year. Okay. It's got this nice bright red leaves that are still on right now.
Yeah, so it's the Acer rubrum, which is, you know, the true native red maple and a wonderful tree. This split that occurred, did it occur because of two branches that were growing sort of codominantly and one peeled away?
No, it was just, I don't know if it had stress on that or what, but it was, we just have this like wind tunnel where it's one tree between our house and some arborvitae. And it just ripped off in this big, huge windstorm.
So you probably had some torsional movement and you just had a normal lateral branch. The codominance, and the reason I ask that is because usually, you know, when they strip away, you've lost more than half of the trunk lower down.
And there's really, it's not more than half, but it's about half.
It is about half. Okay.
About half. All right.
Well, usually when you say, you know, half, that is beyond what the tree is able to repair. Again, as I said, trees are self-optimizing. They have, you know, wonderful mechanisms to be able to compensate for wounds that might occur. But that might be pushing it a little bit. And trees are very compartmentalized also, so that you will still have 50% of that circumference of the bark, which is where all those vascular members that are carrying water and nutrients up, mm-hmm. all your xylem cells carrying everything up, still exist. And because you've lost part of the crown anyway, it usually is going to be sufficient to keep the other part of the crown going. I do not recommend topping or cutting the whole thing down, because that would really defeat the ability of the tree to be able to try to do all it can to compensate for that wound lower down, because its only source of energy is the carbohydrates that are produced through photosynthesis up in the crown. If you start cutting that out, then you've lost it. So in other words, you're trying to treat a wound with additional wounding.
That's what I was wondering too, because it would chop it down to like 6 feet or so, and it's like a 30-foot tree.
Yeah. No. Well, I see what he's getting at though, because you know that force up against the upper part of the crown, it becomes more significant when the branches are longer. There's that leverage. Remember Archimedes, the Greek mathematician, said, "Give me a long enough lever, and I'll move the earth." So that leverage is an important factor. So he's thinking he's going to shorten that lever and reduce the stress on mm-hmm. the wound. And if that was, you know, a non-biological organism, you know, that would work just fine. Mm-hmm. But because we also need, you know, the biological health, the physiological health of this tree, we need those carbohydrates to try to do all we can to lay down additional wood to compensate if we can. In the meantime, because it's 50% gone, I strongly encourage you to be planting another tree nearby so that you might be able to hold on to this one and the enjoyment of its shade and its beautiful autumn color as long as you can, but, you know, have that spare tree in place already so that when it comes time, because the decay has advanced so far on this other one that it becomes problematic, mm-hmm. you're able to remove that one and you'll have like a phoenix growing from the ashes of the other one, another tree already in place. So it's that kind of long-term thinking I would encourage.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call, Deborah. Julie in West Bend, hi to you now. Hi, Julie.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
I so appreciate all the advice. I love trees. They're my favorite. I have a question. I need some advice about how to get back my apple trees. Well, I have a group of about 6 or 7 dwarf apple trees. They've been in for probably 10 years. And I sort of let them go for a while. And a few years ago started, you know, trying to get rid of the suckers and shape them up so that they got good circulation and all that. Well, last winter, like in February, I thought I was doing a very careful job of only cutting the suckers, you know, the ones that came up perpendicular to the main branches. And they looked great and flowered. And at the end of the summer, I end up with just as many, if not more, suckers.
Uh-huh.
So did I do too severe a pruning and the tree is trying to tell me to knock it off, or, you know, how do I fix it and do it the right way?
Well, I mean, that's not an unusual occurrence on Malus, which is a genus of apple, whether it's, you know, a dwarf apple or even a crab apple. They are great at suckering. They will send new shoots out to try to rebalance the crown.
Yeah.
And they will come in spots that you don't really want it on a dwarf mm-hmm. apple tree, because your purpose there is to, you know, create an umbrella so it maximizes the amount of solar intake,
right?
Because that's what's going to produce things. And you also don't want to have all those little suckers that are not really contributing to the production of the fruit, which is what it's all about. I would, you know, your description doesn't sound like you, you know, cut out a heck of a lot. But perhaps the fact that you waited a few years and didn't have a regime of regular annual meant that indeed you had established. And again, this whole concept of homeostasis, I mean, trees establish a balance, and that balance is pretty much controlled with all of these growth regulators that are inside that tree. And if that balance is dramatically changed and it hasn't been done incrementally, then suddenly you are stimulating this new shoot growth coming out of that so-called suckering.
Yeah, sure did.
So at this stage, I mean, you've done, you know, dramatic pruning. You've got some coming out. I would judiciously go back and in the, you know, winter or, you know, late winter, don't wait too far into the spring, because you can introduce another problem called fire blight if you know, prune too late and you have all this succulent shoot growth coming out. But if you were to prune at the right time of year and maybe do about half of what you had done before, and perhaps select just those larger adventitious shoots or sucker shoots that are coming out, mm-hmm. to leave some of the smaller ones for now and see if indeed you have a different reaction from the plant. I mean, I remember it was, I think, Wendell Berry who said, you know, that nature is a question and answer period. You know, we ask a question by doing something and the nature responds and says, yes, that works, or no, that doesn't work.
Exactly.
And so it sounds like you are one of those people that listens to what that tree is saying to it. And I would encourage you to try again, because you need to, you know, be able to prune it in such a way that you create scaffold limbs and a shape that is most conducive to your purpose and relationship with that tree, and that's apple production.
Yeah.
But do a little bit more.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're
welcome,
Julie.
Yeah. Yep, thank you very much for calling. I appreciate your call. And we have Jim in Cleveland up next. So let's go there. Hi, Jim. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I'm wondering if you can help me save a young sapling that we planted in our front yard. It's about 6 years old, but the problem we have is that it dies back to the root every winter, but then sends up a new shoot. So it was a little twig when we first planted it, maybe about a foot long, but then the next spring it sent up a shoot and got about knee high, and then that didn't green up the next spring, but it shot up another shoot from the roots and got about waist high, and so that kept going on every year until it's about chest high. But I'm wondering, what do I do to preserve it so it doesn't have to start all the way from the roots?
Oh, yeah. Jim, what species is it?
Yeah, I'm not sure. It's an ornamental shade tree, golden something or other, when the leaves are kind of a fronds. Compound leaf.
Oh, okay, not a honey locust, which would be an ornamental that has a fern-like kind of leaf.
Could be.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if perhaps it is a tree that is intolerant of our Wisconsin winters, because usually if you have an established root system, sapling's been in the ground that long, you would have had success with that shoot surviving the winter because of the native trees, or, you know, naturalized trees having developed adaptive capabilities to tolerate that cold weather. I also wonder if maybe there's some environmental factor, if indeed it isn't a natural native tree, some environmental factor that is heating things up and taking it out of dormancy on a regular basis. Like if it's too near a house with masonry where you have all that thermal mass that can warm things up, that can create some sort of winter damage going on too. If it is in a normal setting, if it doesn't have something interrupting its normal dormancy, and it's a native tree, it should be able to survive all of that. So I would, number one, see if you can figure out what species it is. And let me just ask you, is there something around it that is increasing the heat load during the winter beyond what it would in a normal setting?
No, not really. It's planted away from the house, but about 6 feet away from the driveway.
Okay.
And I'm wondering, the snow thrower seems to cover it up with snow so that it gets on the bottom of the snow pile.
Okay, so it's somewhat insulated there, and that should give it extra protection. Take a look at the base of the tree and see if you might have some rodent, which is like a meadow vole that is girdling the base of the tree every single year. Rabbits will also do that, and that might be another reason, even though it would have tolerated the winter, something is girdling around the base. But your description, if it's a native tree, trees have wonderful ability to adapt to the winter climate if they're in the natural zone. If they're not in their natural zone, of course, that's why we have zones, because it's the ability to tolerate colder weather that some species have not acquired that particular ability. But take a look at the base and see if you have any rodent damage that might explain that dieback. And beyond that, I really have no explanation for why that particular plant is not succeeding.
It wouldn't help to wrap it in the winter?
Wrapping, if you just do it for the winter, is a great idea. Take that tree wrap, start at the base. Again, make sure there's no rodent activity first. And, you know, if it's live during the growing season, wrap up the main part of the trunk and take it off, you know, as soon as the spring comes, and particularly if you then see viable buds.
Thank you very much, Jim, for calling. I appreciate your call. Bruce Allison, certified arborist, adjunct professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at the UW-Madison. Our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this edition of Garden Talk. We're visiting about trees with Bruce Allison. Thank you for listening in. Call us with your own questions at 800-642-1234. Email talk@wpr.org. Go to our Facebook page, post a photo or a question there at The Larry Mueller Show. Chris in Green Bay up next. Hi, Chris.
Good morning, gentlemen. My question is about cold hardiness. Our house is in Zone 4B, and I want to plant a tree that is only hardy to Zone 5. Is it the wind or the temperature that would cause it harm?
It's the temperature, but keeping in mind that you know, wind is related to temperature. If you have increased the velocity of that wind, you're going to increase the coldness of it also.
Right.
And, you know, because you're moving away any thermal mass, any heat that exists, and getting down to, you know, a colder ambient temperature.
Yeah, wind chill.
Exactly. We're all familiar with wind chill, mm-hmm, in Wisconsin.
Yeah.
So protecting it from the wind, I mean, a shelter belt, putting it, you know, a plant that is perhaps more problematic in your particular climate zone on the south side. And with one caveat, as you might have heard my discussion with the earlier caller regarding the problem of getting too warm and having a tree leave dormancy as a result of, you know, the sun hitting it or thermal mass being nearby, you know, try to avoid that. But if you were to get it out of the wind, that's probably going to increase your probability of success more for that particular tree. What species is it?
I'm looking at planting a Korean fir.
A Korean fir, okay.
Yeah.
Well, so you've got a double problem there because you've got, you know, a gymnosperm or a conifer there, so they're going to be a little bit more susceptible to winter damage anyway.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah. You know, I mean, I'm a great believer in experimenting, and as we talked about a little bit earlier, I mean, the climate zones have changed. I mean, it was unbelievable. The USDA just a few years ago rewrote the climate zone map.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Everything is moving up. You know, we're definitely experiencing a significant shift in the amount of degree days that are occurring, the timing of it, and shortening that period of dormancy and having those unusual periods of warmth during the midwinter, which is very problematic for a lot of trees that have not evolved the ability to adapt to that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I like experimenting too, so I'll give it a shot.
Sounds all right.
Good, Chris. Good luck.
Thanks, Chris. Thank you very much for calling. All right, let's go to Jim in Eau Claire. Hello,
thanks.
Jim. Thank you for calling.
Good morning. See, I have a neighbor that gave me four little baby trees. There's two red maples, there's one weeping willow, and a shade poplar. Of course, the shade poplar wasn't labeled, but that's what I was told it was. Hmm. I'm one in there. It's about 2 feet high. They were in water when I got them. I've kept them in water for about a week. I'm wondering the best way to put them in the ground.
So in water, meaning they're bare root, and you just have a some sort of a spongy material that they're sitting in?
Actually, they're just bare rooted.
Okay.
Yep. I have two different properties I could put them on. One is a sandy soil, and the other one is very good fertile soil, where I intend to build a house. So
okay.
The one place has no trees on it, and that's where I'd like to put them, which is sandy ground.
Okay. Jim, I think I would prefer, and they're not very big. They're bare root. They're into dormancy already. So what I would like to see you do is put them in a more protected area, like a cold garage or a cold barn. Try to just keep them, you know, near that freezing level without actually getting down to freezing, if that's a possibility in some setting there. But make sure they don't get too warm and break dormancy during the winter. You don't want to have that at all. So protect them that way, and maybe even, you know, heal them in with, you know, plenty of soil around them. And then first thing in the spring, when the frost is out of the ground, that's the best time to plant any bare root stock. Select your holes carefully so you don't have to be replanting them later on. Get an adequate hole established put them right in, make sure that they're protected, again, from any deer browse or any other, you know, mammals or, you know, the rodents within the mammal group that could be a problem. And they should do best there. If you put them out now, the problem is that they are going to have less controlled environment than you can provide yourself on the inside. And they might indeed either break dormancy or they might just simply, you know, not have enough root system, and they might just simply freeze, and you'd have all that root loss occurring that otherwise you wouldn't have if you protected them.
And the one tree does have a couple little buds on it that are nice and green. So
they're still green, but it's still probably gone into dormancy. So having those viable buds is exactly what you want. What you don't want is to have, you know, leaves at this time of year, because that's when you have evapotranspiration going on. So I think that's the best bet. Keep, you know, just above freezing. Keep, you know, in that dormant stage in a protected area, and then bring them out to first thing in the spring, and, you know, carefully plant them and protect them.
And thanks very much for calling, Jim. Appreciate it very much. Rod in Weyerhaeuser has a question or comment. So let's go to Rod. Hi, Rod. Thank you for calling.
Yeah. Hello, Larry. Bruce, thank you for taking my call. I was clearing some old pasture, and I laid, you know, red maple or soft maple, we call it, that, you know, green and then turns to bright red in fall. And there's a white oak and a basswood. And my sister's living in our old farmhouse, and there was two big white pines there. One of them is dying. The bark is getting loose. So there, what root span of that big white pine covers quite an area. And I was going to transplant them, but I was wondering if how far I should stay away from that white pine. It's probably going to be the soft maple that's going to be the closest there to the house, and then the white oak I'm going to put out someplace further, but I didn't want the acorns around the house here. You know, it'd be a while to have to worry about that. But
exactly.
Anyhow, so should I have to water them? I transplanted a lot of trees, but always in the spring, you know, so I watered the heck out of them.
Okay. But you feel obligated to make the move this fall no matter what?
Well, I guess it depends. If it, you know, if it freezes up, it freezes up, and then the end of the problem.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, Roger, I mean, you're putting your thinking cap on by, you know, not wanting to damage the root system of that existing tree out there by, you know, pulling up the other ones, because you can certainly do that. But typically, unless you're talking about trying to transplant with a root ball, or you are they small enough where you can just maybe pull them out with
a root ball?
With root ball, okay. And how wide a root ball do you have the capability of moving?
I usually try to get like a foot, you know, 2 foot diameter.
Okay. So you got a 2 foot diameter, and you've got
about a foot deep.
And how far away from the tree that you want to protect are these? I mean, are we talking 2 feet or 15 feet?
I would guess probably somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 to 15 feet from this dying white pine. The bark's still on it, but the bark is chipping off.
All right. So I would say that you're doing fine then. I mean, you know, taking a, you know, a 2 foot diameter, you know, so you got a foot radius pi r squared, you know, you've got, you know, that's what your area would be that you're actually taking away. You're probably not going to be going that any wider than that. And so that will certainly, you know, affect some of the roots on the pine, but not a significant amount. And there's enough overcapacity built into that root system that you shouldn't have any significant adverse effect on that pine. And again, if you choose to do it this fall, you know, make sure that you've got the hole selected carefully, that you, you know, move it quickly. You don't let them desiccate, and then you water it in heavily yet this fall.
Oh, okay.
And then put some mulch around the base to reduce the depth of the frost.
Okay. You see, I was wondering about watering now because I thought, well, if it freezes or something, you know, if it, unless, because the roots in the, in the winter, I was wondering if they want to move. But the pine tree is dying. So that I figured that pine tree is dying. It's not taking as much water. That's why I was asked, you know.
It probably, if it has lost a significant amount of the circumference, it probably doesn't take up as much water. But the new tree's planting, yes, putting water in there makes all the difference. Our great-grandparents know when they when they, you know, put a tub of water into the root cellar, there's a lot of heat energy in water, and so it kept that root cellar warmer. Same thing in the soil. When you put that water around the root system, it adds a lot of heat and reduces the depth of the frost. It's the frost that causes that rootlet damage, and so you want to avoid that. So having water not only makes it available in the spring when the tree starts growing again, but also gives it some additional protection.
Okay, what about wrapping them for the mice?
I would go ahead and do that. You probably have some Metavol out in a forest setting like that, and so I would wrap them, either use one of those plastic curlicue things or actually just use tree wrap. That should do the job for you.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Rod.
Thank you, Larry.
Yep, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. We have an email from Sally in Eau Claire. Just checked out year-old nine-bark shrubs. All the bark have been stripped off. Notice some deer tracks nearby. Would the deer eat nine-bark shrubs?
Well, they certainly are capable, if they're under the right circumstances, of eating almost anything, is my observation, with a few exceptions. Probably more likely Metavol, but you can tell that by the type of damage. Obviously, you know, deer are going to be nipping on the top, and they will sort of truncate or shorten those branches. The Metavol will actually strip all of the bark more around the base or at the level, wherever, you know, the snow might have been. Sometimes they get a little higher up, and that's confusing to people in the spring when the snow's no longer there. Also, rabbits can do that kind of damage. They have those big incisors and can strip away bark.
Bruce Allison, certified arborist, adjunct professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology at UW-Madison, our guest on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. For this edition of Garden Talk, we visit with Bruce Allison, certified arborist. Great to have him along. He comes by every so often to talk with us about trees. Certainly, we're inviting your questions and comments as we move along. All of our lines are filled, so I think what we'll do is go right back to the phones. And Mary in Green Bay, it is your turn. Hi, Mary.
Good morning. I am looking for advice on cutting holly. My holly trees are just shrubs are full of beautiful berries. And 2 years ago when I cut them, I had to knock the snow off in order to get to the branches. I want them for Christmas. Last year I cut them at a sensible time, I thought, and all the berries fell off before Christmas. And they've kind of lost their shape, a nice shape, because of the way I've had to cut them. And so I just need to know when to do it and what you would suggest about retaining a shape.
Well, I mean, you make some good points about the fact that you've lost the berries, and of course, from the plant's perspective, they do want to abscise or drop those berries. That's the point. They want to hold on to them long enough and then simply, you know, drop them. So they will have that ability. They'll have little abscission cell at the point of connection to the stem. And once that dries out, it's going to be dropping. And so you have that experience. Having snow there, you know, does create a problem for cutting. I would try to wait as long as you possibly can and maybe create an environment that keeps the snow from falling on those particular plants that you want to prune. If it's possible, you know, put some old gunny sacks or a tarp or something over it so that when the snow falls, it's separated, doesn't get intertwined with the stems, and then pull those off so that then the plant doesn't have all the weight of that snow on it, and then cut just before you need them to bring them in the house. But as you will note, once they're in the house, they will have a very different environment and start to, you know, desiccate and dry out fairly quickly, losing those nice little berries they have on. But that's the best advice I can...
Excuse me. The funny thing is, the year I had to knock the snow off of them, the berries stayed on all winter, and they blossomed.
Oh, and it blossomed, too. Well, that's wonderful.
Oh, my goodness.
Even though they were inside the house.
Well, the house was cool.
Was cool. Okay. Yeah. Well, maybe that's the solution if your guests over Christmas are willing to have a cooler house.
Not that cool. But anyway, okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you very much for
calling. Thanks, Mary.
Appreciate your call. And Deborah in Milwaukee, we appreciate your call as well. Hi.
Hi. My question is about oak trees in general.
Okay.
And how they vary in their growth. the English oak that I have planted by the city of Milwaukee on the boulevard in front of my house is planted in 2008. But its shape is different from other oaks that I see. It's grown very tall and has a pointed shape. Its leaves fall off each fall. Okay, so this is my main question I have, is about oaks, regarding how some varieties of young oaks keep their leaves all winter long and only lose them when the new leaves push off the old ones, and why my oak, or the English oak, doesn't do that.
Okay, the English oak will abscise much more rapidly. Now, abscission just means it drops, and they drop because normal angiosperms or deciduous trees will have a little cell at that point of connection between the leaf petiole, which is that little stem that comes out, and the stem of the woody stem of the plant. That's called the abscission cell, that is triggered to release, that uncouples and drops that leaf. Mm-hmm. The oaks generally have evolved in a more droughty environment, and so there was no advantage to be able to drop leaves quickly. In fact, if they dropped every time it got too dry, they would end up not having to put all that energy back into refoliating because, you know, the winter season had not come on. Sure. Consequently, they tend not to have abscission cells.
Huh.
And that's why, I mean, people notice it particularly, I think, in the red oak, but if you can certainly have, you know, white and bur oak and chinquapin that will tend to hold on to their leaves quite long. And then, as you point out, only when that bud opens and the shoot starts to elongate does it mm-hmm. then jettison those individual branches or individual leaves, or when the weather situation, I mean, a heavy windstorm is going to break those off, but it's not the normal abscission. So you're making a very interesting observation. And why your particular, you know, English oak, which mm-hmm. is a wonderful oak, by the way, and I don't think planted enough.
I'm lucky that I was able to talk the city into planting specifically an oak tree for me. Is a memory of my brother who wrote a poem about a young oak and about that phenomena of holding on to its leaves.
Uh-huh.
So I was a little disappointed that my oak dropped its leaves.
Well, and
I kind of wondered about it because I see the other oaks, and the English oak is unique and like you say, not planted enough. I couldn't find this information any other source.
Yeah, and the state record English oak is actually there in that Forest Lawn Cemetery, probably not too far from you. You're in Milwaukee.
Yes, I am.
And they've got a couple there, but the largest one in the state that I was listed in my book, Wisconsin's Champion Trees, is there in just beautiful shape.
No kidding.
And I wonder if that, I mean, maybe drive through there if it's not too far from home.
No, it is. I have actually went on their historical tour.
Oh, great.
And it's very interesting. I'm sure I could find that tree just by asking them where it is. Yeah.
Well, exactly. They would know exactly where it is.
Yeah.
I would, you know, just try a little trick. And has it abscised or dropped the leaves already, or is it still?
No, it's still.
Okay. I would try the trick of heavily watering around the base of the tree. That might be too late, and maybe had you done that earlier and just introduced, you know, a lot of extra moisture into the leaf, it might have made a difference. But try it now. Just almost bring it to field capacity, full saturation. It won't hurt the tree at all. But just see if that maybe has elongates that period of holding on to the leaf.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Yeah.
And I was happy to see that it's got one acorn.
Well, congratulations.
I'm so proud of it.
Well, I'm so happy that you planted a tree in memory, you know, of your mm-hmm. brother, because yep. you know, that used to be a great custom in the United States. Trees would be planted mm-hmm. at the time of a childbirth or a death, or mm-hmm. just as a memorial for, you know, a marriage. To have that custom come back, I think, would help us replenish all of the tree loss that is occurring because of disease and insect.
Oh, I'm right with you. I'm with that philosophy. And the DNR department person I first spoke with asked me why I would want an oak tree because I would have messy acorns on the sidewalk. It's like, well, it's a tree, you know.
Yeah.
It's not, and I thought it would take much longer than it has to produce an acorn. I mean, I just have the one on the tree so far, but it's only been, what, 3 years now?
More are on the way.
Yeah, well, I welcome them. You
absolutely.
Know, the squirrels will like them, too. I mean,
absolutely. Well, you're watching one of the miracles of nature is the production of those acorns on those oaks. There's not enough oaks planted, Deborah. I'm so glad that you're of the philosophy to plant those.
Well, I'm going to go out and water it right now.
Good.
You do that. Thanks, Deb.
Okay, thank you.
Appreciate the call. Deborah in Milwaukee on her way out the door to water her oak tree. Isaac in Oshkosh, it is your turn. Hi, Isaac.
Hey, I got a question about, I have a lilac tree that I inherited when I moved into my house, and it's not very full, not very tall, and only the south side of it gets any leaves or flowers, and 2 foot away from the plant, I get shoots that come up like a apple tree. How can I get it to be fuller and prettier?
Well, you point out a good thing. In order to have a successful floral bud developed, you need an adequate amount of sunlight. And so those people that have older lilac trees, lilac bushes, rather, on the top, they'll have all kinds of growth. But they'd say, well, gee, you know, 10 years ago, we had all those flowers lower down. Well, 10 years ago, you didn't have all that shade that is created by that upper periphery of the tree. So they do require sunlight. Proper pruning is your best bet because you can manipulate the shape of that lilac tree. And the right way to go about pruning deciduous shrubs like that is to take out the older, longer stems, promote that young juvenile shoots that you referenced that are coming up on the other side, and prune it in such a way that you can maximize the amount of sunlight hitting lower down where you want that floral display to occur. There is an excellent bulletin again.
Prune on the top then, not towards the bottom.
Well, you got to be careful not to do that topping type pruning.
No.
But quite often the best bet is to find those older stems, I mean a big old stem that's kind of wide at the base, and bring that all the way back to the ground if you can without, you know, totally distorting the shape of it, and select those that more younger tissue that's coming up, get sunlight to those, and you'd be surprised how quickly they will start to develop floral buds also.
Yeah.
And there is an excellent bulletin, again, by our horticulture extension professor, Dr. Laura Joel, on pruning deciduous trees. And lilacs are one of her, you know, favorite areas of research and expertise. And so she has some wonderful ways to properly prune lilacs to try to rejuvenate them, as you're attempting to do, which is also one of the big activities at our UW Arboretum in Madison, where we have, you know, just a world-class lilac collection that are pruned on a regular basis to maximize the floral production.
Mm.
Good luck, Isaac.
Yeah, good luck. Thank you. May and the Arboretum. May is a wonderful time, about middle of May.
Around Mother's Day.
Around Mom's Day.
Wonderful moment.
Mm, absolutely. Otter in Dallas, Wisconsin, we are on to you now. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hello, and thanks. Yeah, I'm calling, too, about a memorial tree that I planted last spring, an apple tree. What happened is, while I drive semi-trucks, so I don't get to check on it that often. The last time I was home, there was a tree that shot up like a foot from the base of the other one, and I'm concerned how to remove that.
It could very well have been, you know, one of the more invasive trees that have sort of come into the area, like maybe a mulberry. It might even be something like, you know, a buckthorn or something that, you know, doesn't belong there. It's possible, but probably not likely on an apple that it would have been a shoot growth, that is a root shoot coming up. More likely you would have the shoots coming directly from the lower part of the trunk. So the proper way...
I noticed that the leaves were similar in shape to an apple, and it is a dwarf, so it could have been coming from the rootstock.
Oh, it could have been the rootstock, and if it was a dwarf, of course, it has a different rootstock. It would have been, you know, put onto a dwarf rootstock, and would have been you know, so if something's coming from the root as opposed to the stem, which would have been grafted on, it would be not the same anyway. But at any point, you've got, you know, the tree established. You don't really need this second shoot coming up. It's disconnected from the main part of the trunk. So the right way to get rid of it, or that is to manage it, is to just take your snippers at this time of year and snip it level at the ground. If you put some mulch over the top so that no sunlight can reach down there in the spring, you probably will not have reshooting coming from up there, because any new growth, you know, ultimately needs sunlight to be able to produce the carbohydrates.
There you go. Thank you very much for calling. Paul in Cascade, on to you now. Thank you for calling.
Good afternoon. I have two Washington hawthorns that were bent over to the ground by a snow load last winter.
Okay.
I was told to do nothing, so that's what I did. They did pop up when the snow melted. One of them is not completely up. The other one came all the way up, but it broke off in a summer thunderstorm this summer.
Yeah.
So I got a busted off tree.
Mm.
I had a professional come and look at it, and he didn't think there was any hope for the tree. And he wanted way too much money for my wallet to replace it. So what I'm wondering is, can I expect sucker growth from just below the point where it broke off?
Okay, so we're not talking about the other tree that was bent over and has come back up, but actually the one that had that break mid-stem. And you're wondering, yes, you certainly, with the hawthorn, if it has an established root system, you'll have all of those the roots doing their job, and they're trying to send their, you know, not only the reserve carbohydrates in the spring, but also new water and nutrients coming up. And they're going to go to a much shortened upper crown. And yes, you can expect on that Washington hawthorn to have additional adventitious roots. Adventitious means, shoots coming out where they normally wouldn't have grown, because embedded in that trunk are these, you know, between the internodal areas, between where you normally have stems, are these additional cells that have the capability under stress of producing a new shoot coming out. They wouldn't normally do it, but when the tree has been damaged like it is, there's a change in the chemistry of the tree that stimulates these reserve shoots, reserve cells, to send up new shoots coming out. So you'll get that. Now the question is, you know, will it ever take a more, you know, upright form that would be comfortable? And the answer is, if you've got the time, give it a chance. I mean, again, trees self-optimizing. They have great ability to be able to hang in there, you could very well indeed have an adequate amount of growth there, so that, you know, 3, 4, or 5 years down the road, you might have the remnants of that wound that occurred, but you'd have enough new growth taking over that main stem. So I'd certainly give it a shot. Make sure you do your part by watering, protecting it from any further damage. Should make a big difference.
And thanks a lot for calling, Paul. And Luba in Madison, on to you now. Hi.
I have a question. I make notes down, and then for some reason, it was important to me. But anyway, there was a Katsura tree, and it was supposed to be attractive. Now, that's Katsura.
It's actually K.
K,
is it? Oh, I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And I don't hear very well either. is this something that is grown on a small lot, a large lot? Is it really attractive? Are there drawbacks or what? I've never heard of it.
Oh, the Katsura is an underutilized landscape tree. I think it's absolutely beautiful. I'd like to see more of them planted. They're sort of a mid-sized tree. They're not going to get really huge, but they're not very small. So, and they have a nice shape. They're not going to have a white or river birch kind of, you know, single stem coming up, but rather take more of a normative shape with a wider crown. Lower to the ground, very attractive tree, and I would encourage you to plant it. And there's, you know, many Katsura growing in the Madison area, as a matter of fact, right near you. Yeah, and they should be readily available either to one of your local nursery growers. If you go to the Wisconsin Nurserymen's Association website, they have a wonderful resource if all their members list the different species of trees which they grow. And so you don't have to call 20. They will actually have done that work for you. And then you can find out who is selling the Katsura in the size that you would like.
Oh, mm-hmm. That's great.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for calling. And Susan in Black River Falls, thank you for calling.
Thank you. I'm thoroughly enjoying the expertise of your guest. I have a grant to do 1,900 feet of windbreak or shelter belt on the lot line of a farm. And in discussing this and getting advice, it's been suggested that I plant a pine tree first and then next to it, 8 feet away from it basically, probably a sugar maple and then a shrub for the entire 1,900 feet. Now, I don't have enough expertise to know if I really should be varying the trees or not, or if it's okay to use the same species for the entire 1,900 feet.
So, Susan, your purpose in planting these is a true wind shelter belt? You want to reduce the velocity of the wind going near the farmhouse?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, it's to protect the organic planting that's going to be happening at that farm.
Got you. Okay, great. So you've got some organic planting going on there. So your selection of plants would be pretty important, too. Say, for example, you wanted to have organic apples. Well, there's one insect that gets into cherry trees, for example, the plum curculio, which you wouldn't want to have any cherry trees nearby. So your proper selection, understanding disease and insect issues, if you want to have organic, that would be pretty important stuff. So I'm guessing that they're encouraging the variety for, perhaps partially wildlife. Because normally if you were going to be planting for the wind protection, that you would, focus on the larger trees. And it's not unusual to put a deciduous tree near an evergreen like a white pine, because the white pine acts as a nurse plant. It forces that deciduous tree to grow more quickly and more upright. And that might also be the purpose that they have in mind. And maybe the shrubs underneath, again, are just to sort of fill in that lower area, provide wildlife habitat. They're not going to do much in terms of blocking the wind. So I, would refer back to, whoever gave you the grant and to the supplier of the plants. I presume it's the Department of Natural Resources nursery. And they would have a strategy and recommendations for exactly which ones to plant. But make sure they fully understand what, your purpose is and that you're going to have an organic. Is it a commercial organic garden?
I'm transitioning the farmland to organic.
To organic, I see. Mm-hmm. Great. Well, I think that's wonderful to have those hedgerows going on and have that variety of tree for wildlife habitat. And it's, during the dust bowls, boy, those shelter belts made a huge difference in protecting against soil erosion.
Absolutely.
So we don't have to worry about, if some tree, something in that group gets blighted, obviously you lose the entire row of that tree is a concern of mine.
Exactly. You don't want to have monoculture. If you can have a variety mixed in there, you certainly have that biodiversity, and there's an argument in favor of that.
But you would consider these three that I've mentioned to be biodiverse?
You're going to have conflict between the white pine and the oak over time. But if the reason for the white pine is to get those oaks to grow taller.
Oh, there's no oak. It's sugar maple.
Oh, sugar maple. Well, and sugar maple even more so. They're the climax species. They will block out the white pines over time. But, they will be forced to grow much more taller and be a more vigorous tree because of that companion planting.
Mm-hmm. I see. There you go.
Thanks, Susan. Okay. Good luck.
Yeah, thank you very much for calling, Susan. Appreciate it. And Bruce, thank you so much. Boy, the 90 minutes went by pretty fast.
It really did.
You'll come back and be with us again, I hope.
I would love to.
Oh, that's great. Bruce Allison is a certified arborist. I'm sorry we didn't get to everybody. Lots of Facebook questions and emails and, that's the way it goes. He's a certified arborist and adjunct professor in the Department of Forest and Wildlife Ecology in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. And we'll have him back and do it again. Just a look ahead, Monday at 11, we'll hear about a new Wisconsin Public TV documentary about the life of Mildred Fish Harnack, the only American woman executed on direct orders from Adolf Hitler and with the Wisconsin ties. Also, the weather guys at 11:45 talk about fall and winter weather outlooks. So we'll look forward to that as well. Thanks for listening. Stay with us on the Ideas Network.